Hello, and welcome to Thou Shalt Not Suffer, the Witch Trial Podcast. I'm Josh Hutchinson.
And I'm Sarah Jack.
How are you doing today, Sarah?
I'm doing great because we just got to do our first episode with Owen Davies.
What a great episode this is. The conversation was meaningful. We talked to him about one of his new books. Art of the Grimoire looks at the history of magic books and has images of a couple hundred grimoires in it.
For a while now, I've had so many things that I wanted to crack open when we got a chance to talk to him. And we definitely got to step in and get some answers. Unfortunately, he wouldn't sit and talk to us for 6 hours.
We got to learn about the history of magic and how very far back it goes.
For listeners who want to know more about the written history of magic and what is the scope of magic, how does it intersect with our lives today? How did it impact our ancestors' lives? You're going to hear about that today.
And how it impacted every aspect of life, including its influence on the arts. And you see that in this wonderful book, which I highly recommend everyone pick up, Art of the Grimoire.
Art of the Grimoire is also great because along with the beautiful images that he has filled it with, he designed the book to help readers understand the context.
It's a magical book about magic. It's such a special book. You get all of these rich color images, and you also get this rich narrative of how magic has evolved over the years, how it's grown in conjunction with religion and science, and where it's going today.
And of course, we also had a great conversation about witches.
We really did. We talked about witch trials, and we talked about reverse witch trials.
That's right.
Those were so interesting to learn that there were more people killed for allegedly using witchcraft in America after Salem than there were in the legal witch trials, including Salem.
We've spent our first year showing you history of witch trials and bringing the attention to what's happening in modern communities across the world. And there's another piece that we've been wanting to start the conversation on, and we were able to start that today.
Yes. And speaking of going on for a year, happy anniversary to us.
Happy anniversary to us.
This episode is releasing about a year to the day of our first full episode, which was October 6th, 2022. And now we've come around after a year, and here we are talking to Owen Davies about magic and witchcraft and folklore.
And here's Owen Davies, historian of witchcraft, magic, ghosts, religion, folklore, and medicine. He's past president and currently the vice president of the Folklore Society. Be sure to check this episode's notes for links to his vast published books and recorded talks and lectures.
What sparked your interest in folklore, magic, and witchcraft?
Well, it's a big question. It's an organic thing, really. Stems out of teenage interest, probably in fantasy novels, particularly ones which are rooted in some sense of historic traditions. So, and particularly authors like, obviously, Tolkien, borrowed from Anglo-Saxon mythology, etc., Norse mythology, but also particularly Alan Garner, author who wrote a series of books which are based around the kind of the folklore of magic based in the English landscape. So those sorts of books, obviously, inspired a bit of an interest in history general. So it grew out, probably partly grew out of that interest in sort of historic set fantasy type novels, I think, in part. And then I was interested in the ways in which magic integrated with landscape. But I went and studied archaeology at university, done quite a lot of digging and field work and surveying. The idea of interpreting, having a feel of area to interpret a landscape and your imagination, particularly when it's prehistoric. So kind of, it's quite good for opening one's mind about ideas of ritual and meaning of people. So yeah, it's not a direct thing. It's a kind of organic something that leads you to these sorts of long-standing academic scholarly interests.
How do you define magic?
I've said before on this that it's almost impossible to define. There are so many different ways in which you can define it, and it depends in particular on period, time, culture, religion. You can come up with a fairly good definition of magic for a specific period, a specific time, in a specific culture, because it's related to whatever is the dominant religion at that time. It's often the definition of magic is in relationship to at least one side's definition of what religion is. You go back to the rise of Christianity. You've got people in the early days of Christianity accusing Christians of being magicians and magic, and you've got Christians accusing non-Christians of being magicians and using magic. And you can see that all the way through history. You can go to the Reformation of Europe, and you can see the ways in which early Protestants would accuse Catholics of being basically a superstitious religion, and the Pope of being basically a magician and a devil, and priests performing tricks, all those sorts of things. And at the same time, you'll have Catholic propaganda calling Protestants wicked magicians, encouraging superstitions. So these things get defined by different eras, different religions, different cultures. So I just start with a general working definition of magic as being the ways in which humans perceive or act in a way which, through ritual or through action, believe that they can perform and alter the natural world around them or have an effect on other people. But that doesn't encompass it, because you've got things like natural magic, which some people would say it's not magic at all. But that's the whole idea of the hidden properties of things, which goes right back to antiquity again, like Pliny the Elder and his extraordinary volumes of books on essentially the hidden properties and secrets of stones and animals and plants. So that's another genre of natural magic. You can to subdivide it into elite and learned, a popular vernacular. Does the magic of a laborer in 18th century Germany exactly the same as the magic of a learned ritual magician in 16th century Denmark? They're probably on completely two different worlds and planes, but we as historians will still say they're using magic in one form or another. So you get really bogged down in this, and obviously there's lots of books who do get bogged down in this. It's not really my thing. So I just normally set out and say, look, it's impossible. Always think of the culture and time in which you're using magic and then define it in those ways.
Did beliefs that can be described as magical originate any particular time or place, or have they just always been around?
It's impossible to know. Obviously, you go back to the early recorded history. You can go right back to Mesopotamia, 4,000 BC, 6,000 years ago, where you get the first people writing in cuneiform or clay tablets, and immediately people are writing about magic. People are writing down spells. People are communicating with magicians and saying, can you do this for me? As soon as there is writing, there are people who are, you know, obviously a lot of those cuneiform, there are thousands of these cuneiform clay tablets, this earliest form of writing. Many of it's just administrative. It's about accounting. It's about household management, obviously issues of kingship and all those sorts of things. But say magic is there straight away. So one expects that, that's tapping into a new technology, writing, a new technology in terms of writing surfaces. And that this was then what's being put down is something which goes back further than that, obviously. Centuries, millennia, how far back? Who knows? Who knows? This is the challenge, again, in a prehistoric attempt to understand what magic means in prehistory. This is why archaeologists in general are very reluctant to talk about magic. It's a really interesting point, but you'll have archaeologists who work on antiquity, okay, whether it's in the Mediterranean world or, as they say, in the Near East or Middle East, these ancient civilizations, Iraq. But that's because they feel confident using magic because you've got texts which talk about magic in its various forms and words. If you go to archaeologists working in the same period, Neolithic Bronze Age, in Western Europe, you'll very rarely see archaeologists using magic there because there's a reluctance to say that's magic or not because they've got no text to base it on. When you're only looking at material objects and finds and monuments, whether it's Stonehenge or it's Neolithic cursuses or causeways or barrows, obviously they're all centers of ritual. And there were things of ritual to do with gods, but maybe also rituals which were a religious, but were in a sense thought to have magical properties. Again, that's the other thing. Let's not always associate magic in a prehistoric past as being always 100% connected with gods. It may not be. Who knows? There may be rituals which are just what we might call sympathetic magic. But that's the reason why archaeologists in the Western world rarely use magic. So it's an interesting thing. If you come to this and you're wondering why one set of scholars are using the term and others aren't, it's still to do with this relationship between having a body of early writing which expresses what magic is. And if you don't have that, how can you assume it's magic and not just religion? You get bogged down. So that's where a ritual comes in as a kind of replacement for the term magic.
Does it seem like the fear of magic goes back as far as magic? Or is that something that it looks like grew over time?
Impossible to say. Again, if you go back to the earliest writings, there's familiar types of magic. There's magic to deal with spirits, harmful spirits, demons and devils, keep them away. There are ones which are calling upon gods, different types of gods and goddesses. There are ones which are just about, which could be about personal protection in the form of how you go about creating an amulet or a talisman, which will give you good luck. These are all familiar forms of magic right through to today being practiced. So again, we know that's happening then. But again, if you're going to go back, say, another 6,000, if you're going to go back into what we broadly call the Upper Paleolithic, and we're dealing with cave art, but also other clearly ritual objects, we're dealing with the burial ritual rather than just burying the dead. There's rituals associated with, which suggest there's issues about afterlife or connection with spirits, God, who knows. We have absolutely no idea this, which is quite great in one sense because it's a free field. But we can't say, and you can't say anything definite about it beyond the historical record.
And you've put together this wonderful book, Art of the Grimoire. Can you explain to our listeners what a grimoire is?
Yeah, it's a term that people sometimes go, it's a bit of nebulous term, a bit like magic itself. Again, I use it in a broad way in which it's a book or a book form. It could be a scroll. It's to do with length, but it's to do with what's in it. And that's fundamentally, it can contain basic mundane material like how to make vinegar or whatever household tips. But if it's got spells and rituals for conjuration, conjuring spirits, for example, in particular, that's one of the, to me, a defining feature. Because you can have, which are, if you do this and that with this stone or that plant, that it will have this effect, invisible effect, whatever. And that's not really, in my senses, a grimoire. A grimoire is something which, at its heart, but not, it doesn't have to be completely about conjuration, ritual conjuration. But for the book, it's called Art of the Grimoire. But it's as the subtitle says, it's more broadly about the relationship between illustration and the artistic quality of illustrations and the writing and the spells and the action of magic itself. So it's a bit more broader. So some of the material I'm looking at there is not strictly what I would call a grimoire per se. So again, you can't be too, I'm not too fussy about this thing.
This is a topic that I'm just learning about. And when I was previewing some of your material, your introduction is fabulous. And it really, I feel grounded to continue on and look at what's presented here and understand the confluence of things. And I loved how important the creativity and the imagery is in grimoires. Do you want to share anything about the importance of that?
I just think lots of 17th century grimoires are being republished, obviously in very nice quality formats as well. And it's an area where the practitioner community have made a really good contribution to the study of historic magic, particularly ritual magic, because their passion for trying to get original sources has led to opening these up and translations and everything else. And obviously, modern practitioners have been interested in some of the talismans and sigils that are in these volumes for the way in which they might help their own magical practice. Historians have also obviously perfectly aware of the imagery in these, but the focus has normally been on the texts, whether it's a semantic or linguistic point of view, or looking at derivations and origins, connections between the texts and conjurations, adjurations or whatever. I thought it was really healthy to actually focus particularly on the people who are making the illustrations in these things and the artistic qualities. Some of it's exquisite. Some of it, these are true artists. Some of it's very crude. It's someone who's not trained drawing, but the drawing is important to the magic that they're recording in these books and as part of it. That in itself to me is fascinating because it's a clear desire. Sometimes the illustrations and art is fundamental to the performance. In other words, here's a pentacle, here's a magic circle. You must draw this in the ground at a certain time. So it's a guide. You must replicate what's in this image. And sometimes images are about the action of magic, which aren't necessarily relevant to the actual spell or conjuration. And that adds a whole new layer to our understanding of what these books of magic, whether the grimoires or whatever you want to call them, it adds a whole new dimension to what these meant, both to those who were creating them and also to those who were reading them.
The imagery is really something to see in the book. And as you mentioned, these go back to the earliest days of writing. So you show a wide variety of written forms from the cuneiform to printed on paper. Was the act of writing also considered itself to be magical?
This is a fascinating thing between what effect does print when you start printing these books, you know, does that somehow detract or not? That's a slightly other question. But yeah, if you go back to the early forms, particularly Chinese writing or pictograms or hieroglyphs, they are based on images. The writing is image in its own right. And so in itself, the connection between writing and illustration or depiction are fundamental to the history of magic as it develops. And particularly, I think, in the ancient Chinese world where, you know, specific words as symbols have magical potency as symbols as well as them being words. But you also see this happening when another culture, in a sense, appropriates or wants magic in a written form they don't understand. You get this, for example, in late medieval Spain, where you've got Arabic texts where Christians are buying charms based on Arabic writing, which they don't understand, but it's the look of it. It's not that you can read it, but it's how it looks. And this, to them, unusual, unknown language holds magical power. And that, again, across cultures, across time, how one culture sees the writing of another culture, the language where it's written, as inherently magical.
You even see that today. Harry Potter came to mind. The language Crucio Specto Patronum, it has this Latin sound and that foreignness. There's something to that.
I've studied simple writ charms produced by cunning folk, you know, popular magicians, 18th and 19th centuries. A number of these writ charms still exist. And they're full of Latin phrases because the cunning man knows that their clients have no idea what this means, but it looks magic. So again, Latin is another one which is, oh, that must be magic. One, because it's written by the cunning man. But two, I have no idea, but it looks strange. And the way it's written is strange. And therefore, it must be doing something. So you see it all the way through.
This brings up a question for me. You mentioned the cunning man. Who would have been writing the magic in different cultures? Did it tend to be gendered or a certain role in their community, society?
Particularly in the first 3 millennia BC into late antiquity, most of the people who are producing this, only a tiny percentage of people in any culture can actually write, tiny percentage. And those tend to be priesthoods. Early magical writings are predominantly written by clergy, whether it's ancient Egyptian priests, the Buddhist priests in China. I think most of the medieval grimoires are written by clergymen. There are other people around courts who are learned elites. But predominantly they're written in male, it's all male, dominated, of course. It's priesthoods. And even going through into the last millennia of medieval period onwards, you get very few magic texts or grimoires which can be identified as having been written. That's obviously because these are all patriarchal societies who don't want women to have that knowledge or to be able to write. So there is a sense in which written magic is closed or locked off from women, not as customers or clients, but as the producers and holders of these literary forms of magic. Cunning folk, you mentioned cunning folk. When you get to popular magicians, certainly over the last 500 years, then things change a lot more because obviously literacy itself grows from particularly the Protestant Reformation onwards. We have records from the 16th, 17th centuries, 18th onwards of female cunning folk who have their books of magic and use them. Again, even look at those figures, it's, you know, 60% men, 40% very roughly across most of Europe at this time. And even if you look at American sort of folk magicians of this period, it's roughly that sort of split. I haven't counted them, but the amount of stuff, my general sense of that is the same. But as women become, are able to get an education naturally, they're kind of more access. You see it in the records that they're using literary magic as well as claiming more innate powers or powers from fairies or whatever.
We do see that in 17th century New England, for sure, in Connecticut and in Salem. There's cases where the witchcraft suspect was said to possess a book of palmistry or a book of the dark arts.
And you get those idea of compacts. The male pact is not, the pact is not a male thing, the pact with the devil. But you get this idea, particularly in 17th century, the idea that the suspected witches are writing in the book of the devil. It's not necessarily a book of magic, but they're writing their names. So in other words, their access to being literate, which enables them to cross or actually put their name in the book of the devil, which means they've signed up to him. So yeah, you see that coming through. And Protestantism, obviously, as a faith, was one which actually, you know, placed an emphasis on both women and men having enough literary ability to be able to read the Bible themselves. So they actually did, unlike some other cultures, they did actually encourage, only to a certain degree, just enough to read the Bible. But that did have a significant effect in the ways of the ways in which women were seen to and actually did engage with learned ritual magic. And books, as you say, books of palmistry and fortune telling and divination as well. These bodies of work are growing and becoming cheaper and women are able to access them more.
You talked a little bit about fluidity between what's considered magic and what's considered religion. And in the book, you also talk about the relationship between magic, religion, and science. How are those three areas interlinked?
I mean, I think they're all fundamentally interlinked. The reason why this always crops up in my work or others is because we are still, particularly in the contemporary West, wedded to an old anthropological model of three stages. This came about in the 1870s, 1880s, and the early anthropologists came up with this great model, which is based around comparative anthropology, traditions, and customs, rituals across the world. And it's normally a jumble and a mess, obviously mostly discredited. But it's still with us. This whole idea, you start off with the primitive magic as the earliest forms back in the dawn of humankind. And magic was an animism, the kind of the ways in which people were thinking, creative thinking. And then organized religion comes along, and then that gets usurped by science, and science dominates overall, and we all become rational, which is obviously complete nonsense. We only have to look around what's going on in the world today to know that this is just complete rubbish, and we can live in an age of extraordinary science. At the same time, we have people believing in witchcraft, believing in that 5G does things to you, or believing, you know, that witchcraft accusations are still being made, the idea of satanic paedophile cults in high office and all these sorts of things. This stuff crops up over centuries, right through this. A lot of my work is all about saying, look, religion in the past, religion and magic were closely connected, and science too. And this has been very well written by historians of science. So when you look at medieval science or into the early modern period, that things like alchemy were a fusion of this relationship between both kind of spiritual Christianity, science in terms of chemistry and physics, and also ideas of laws of sympathy, which are fundamental to magic as well. It's very difficult to tease these things apart. And even I say, if we even come back to things like people's use of 5G today, well, what do you have? Something which is the latest technology, satellite technology, at the same time being reinterpreted in kind of very suspicious ways that these are somehow forces that are being used by other people in a malign way. Again, these ideas and notions you find way back about other forms of early technology as well. So to try and separate out human cultural development or spiritual development and say there's an age of this, an age of that, an age of this, all three are jumbled up and interconnected. Don't have to be connected. Depends on the culture. Depends on the time again. But you see it over and over again, the way in which you can make connections. And I'm someone, I don't go on a hobby horse about this, but I'm an atheist. But at the same time, I have not like Richard Dawkins, who somehow thinks that science beats all and science can conquer this and everyone should be scientifically rational. It doesn't work like that. Humans aren't like that. So I try and always, in whatever context, some variety to try and get across this idea of things complex. We do still think in the ways that people thought 2,000 years ago, 3,000 years ago. We do still think in the same sort of ways. We can see it. We've got the evidence in the resources.
You've talked about sympathetic magic a little, natural magic. What were the main forms that magic took?
I would say there's natural magic, which I've talked about, which is like the secret hidden properties, which God or gods had placed in objects for humans to discover and find out how they worked. And again, that's partly the basis of alchemy. Takes place, and you find that this cross cultures is obviously something fundamental to human culture and its development. You've got conjuration, adjuration is the way in which you are basically adjuring or spirits or talking to the angels or whatever it happens to be, or jinn, the Arabic cultures. And again, you find that across cultures, across the world as well, the idea of talking to other beings, other spirits, spiritual world. You've got magic, which is basically the use of religion in non-official forms. And this is, you know, this is popular magic, as I call it, or folk magic, however you want to define it. It's basically using the tools of formal Orthodox religion, whether it's Catholic sacramentals, holy water, or the Bible itself, or in Islamic culture, the Quran. All of these are used in ways which are essentially for purposes of protection and help. People using it are not, in a sense, in any way cynical about it. They're basically saying, we have been given these gifts of objects and rituals and prayers, and we are using them. And sometimes we may go to the priest for them. But sometimes if the cunning person or magician or marabout in North Africa is using these, we will go to them as well, because we're essentially just using God's word, Allah's word on these. But from an Orthodox institutional point of view, all this is really deeply problematic. You see this over and over again, the idea of control. Religion. And this is why in the medieval period, early modern period in Europe, you had church courts, which were regularly held. And the old idea was, part of it was to root out people doing these things with religion for, in a sense, you know, protection and good luck, which they shouldn't be doing, because they should be doing it either through an ordained priest in the Catholic world who has the spiritual power to do it, or through a minister in a Protestant way. So that's another thing. That's where that essentially magic is religion put on unorthodox ways. Then there's myriad forms of little rituals and oral, particularly oral, but also then they get printed, forms of magic which aren't related to religion at all. Rituals to make your gun shoot straight or whatever. You do this and do this and you do that and you say these words, which sometimes are religious, sometimes aren't. And this will happen. So it can be outside of religion completely as well. But all this gets jumbled up in terms of people across the world and the past and the present using magic, who aren't in the sense ceremonial magicians used in books and stuff. All this is just magic. You're not teasing it all apart, saying this is one type of magic, this is another type of magic. It's all there to help you.
What is the relationship between magic and witchcraft? Do you have to have witches to have magic?
No, because if you think about saying magic is so much broader than that. So witchcraft is essentially a subset of magic. It's harmful magic. And the boundaries can be hazy, because a lot of popular magic was about using harmful magic to counter and injure the witch. So in other words, both sides are using harmful magic. The idea being that witchcraft, it's at two levels. You know, in a sense of a popular term, witchcraft is essentially people who use magic, whether by look or sight or utterance or whatever, who use magic because they're envious, they're jealous, they're spiteful. So they're going to bewitch your pigs, your cows, make you go lame, to make your cartwheel fall off, whatever. And they do it, they're your neighbors, you know, and it's just harmful. And you might then use harmful magic, stick pins in something or whatever, you know, voodoo type thing, to cause harm back to the witch to make them stop. But you don't think you're doing witchcraft, right? Because you're not doing it out of jealousy, envy. You're only using harmful witchcraft because it's only right, because these harmful people, evil people. So even then, these definitions are more complex than they might see of witchcraft is this or witchcraft is that. Then there's the high level of witchcraft as the learned view of a satanic conspiracy. That witchcraft is essentially people who, and again, this is where the theology is a massive debate, who either think they can perform these harmful spells and magic, or can actually, or that the devil is doing on their behalf. These are all matters of debate. But essentially, the idea is that witches have been are a satanic conspiracy, which is tied particularly to Revelation and Bible, in the sense that they're often thinking of ways in which this increase of witches in the world is actually due to the Antichrist is coming. This heralds it, and therefore we must exterminate them, because that makes the apocalypse going to be a bit better if we can exterminate some of these people beforehand. So you've got your learned conspiracy theory, and then you've got your mundane everyday life witch. And when you look at witchcraft accusations, often they're actually start with the mundane things, and then it's the veneer, and it's because the witch hunters, the judges, whoever, want to say this is it, which is all, more than just that, which is part of this diabolic conspiracy. So witchcraft is a concept as well as a practice, long and short.
When did the satanic conspiracy become a part of the witchcraft equation?
That's what really starts the trials, the heresy trials in the mid 15th century in Central Europe, of the church looking for heretical groups, whereas the Cathars go interview people, torture people, and find all these conspiracies. And then, of course, we get the rise of the printed book. So all these testimonies, which are being extracted by torture to confirm that Satan stalks the world and is recruiting particularly these women to do this, gets amplified. And so it builds up. But you can have echoes and concepts of harmful, particularly women again, but it depends on different cultures. Harmful people who are acting on behalf of others, or you get in cultures where you have multiple gods. There's always a god that's malicious and harmful, and he may use people to do harm on the ground, so to speak. So these, the idea of conspiracy, the idea that these forces, whether it's satanic or other, are manipulating people to, in a sense, turning them into using them as witches to perform harm in communities. Be similar concepts. The idea of conspiracy and elsewhere outside of a Christian context as well.
So while the basically Christian witch hunts were happening in Europe, were there similar types of trials or witch hunts occurring in non-Christian areas?
You get sorcery trials in China. You get those earlier around the same centuries, so we do have records of sorcery trials. So those go right back to antiquity. You've got trials of magicians in ancient Greece, ancient Rome. You've got trials of magicians, prosecution. Every culture generally has a persecutorial tendency here. There's some of them. I mean, again, if you look in countries or South America or whatever, again, the point is you've not necessarily got the same institutionalized forms of persecution. But the whole idea of being evil people in your community, who may then be dealt with through justice, popular justice, but not through a formal court systems that are instituted in like ancient antiquity or in Europe at this period. But it's the same impulse. It's not formalized with record keeping. We only know about this. It's the record keeping, which is a quite a bureaucratic, institutional state-based preoccupation.
So it's more like what's going on in the modern world with mobs or vigilantes.
Again, you find that across cultures. You'll find it in 19th century England. People do die from these things, have died in the 18th and 19th centuries beyond trial of witch trials. That tendency, again, is always there. Scapegoating, find someone who they believe is a witch, and you get enough of the momentum going, and it ends in violence, and then either deliberate or inadvertent death. And you say it's going across the world today, whether it's with albino children in parts of Africa or particularly women in parts of India and South Asia. You only have to look at the electronic press these days. You'll find every week you'll find something often of something happening, which is terrible. It's how you deal with it. It's very difficult. What happens, obviously, in such organized, very organized and highly bureaucratic states, like as in early modern Europe, is that you can't go out and just beat up and kill a witch. That's illegal itself. So in one sense, they're killing and persecuting tens of thousands of women. At the same time, you try and do that yourself and you will end up executed. So it's the same state which persecutes, the same state which suppresses popular justice. It still happens, but people will end up being punished for it and executed themselves. It's always worth thinking about that when we're talking about sometimes the witch trials get portrayed as a kind of a kangaroo courts, and they're not at all, whether it's the religious church courts, the inquisitions, or secular courts. It's all highly bureaucratic. Laws have to be obeyed. Otherwise, power breaks down. Royal authority breaks down. Church authority breaks down. people can do all sorts of other forms of ostracism. And we got records of that, you know, so that you basically try to force someone out. And that goes on into the early 20th century, on into the 20th century in Europe and in the United States. I've written America Bewitched, which is a book about all the people who were basically shot dead, beaten up, and slandered through the 19th and into the mid-20th century in America. Headline there is, you know, there were more people who were killed as witches after Salem than they were executed by the authorities. So these things are much more complex sometimes than they get represented.
This is a conversation we've really been working on developing just in communities. We want people to be thinking about these things that you are sharing today, that you've written about in your books. One of the questions I have is, okay, so it's easy to label the historic witch trials, and we use the term modern witch hunts, but what do we call the era in the 18th century, in the 19th century, where the witchcraft fear was persisting and you had folks still being ostracized? How do we refer to that?
Yeah, it's difficult. It's a good point, actually. We don't have a term for it. We call the trials themselves reverse witch trials. Two things going on. Post the witch trials, i.e., you know, when the laws are rescinded, that witchcraft is no longer a crime, but considered to be a shimmer or a fraud or whatever. And obviously, but significant proportions of the population continue to fear witches and want something done about it. You've got people who are going to cunning folks. You've got a whole world of dealing with witches without the authorities or who are actually physically abusing. But in many cases, people do go, whether it's through ritual forms of scratching, drawing blood, which is meant to break a spell, but at the same time is causing physical harm. It's a criminal act. So you've got those scratching cases which take place, which will go to court if the poor person who's been abused and suspected of witchcraft decides to take them to court. So we call those reverse witch trials. Essentially, it's the person who's accused of witchcraft, abused of witchcraft, basically going, I'm going to use the courts against you because what you have done is illegal. What I'm doing is not what you're accusing me of. And even if it was, it's not illegal. So we've got those, but then lots of people wouldn't go to court. I mean, I've had a book I've got coming out shortly, which looks at asylum records, people's beliefs in the supernatural amongst asylum patients. And there's evidence there of poor old women who, when they're kind of, I'm just thinking of one example from the 1870s, and a poor woman who's brought to the asylum, and they take clothes off to give her good clothes and stuff, and they find all the lacerations down her back. And this poor woman had been repeatedly scratched and had her blood drawn, so her back was scarred, badly scarred. She never went to the authorities. She just lived with it. So there's also those hidden, what we see in terms of reverse trials are only a small part of the kind of ostracism and abuse that particularly and mostly women were receiving at this period of the 18th, 19th, 30th, 20th century. In those areas, this is what we look at. In those areas where there were witch trials, whether it's North America or Europe, in those areas, these two centuries afterwards, as you say, doesn't have a name. But to me, it's just as important that we study it because at fundamental, we've still got tens of thousands of people suffering physically or mentally because of the accusations made against them. And that, to me, is really important. Not that many historians necessarily feel the same because everyone, loads of people keep writing books about Salem and the witch trials. And I keep going, particularly with America Bewitched, I keep going, yes, but why aren't you talking about this in your school curriculum? Or the same for Britain as well, like. Matter. The school curriculum is all about the witch trials, and isn't it strange? And why did they believe these things? And it's all in the past. They said, no, you kiddies, your great great grandfather could have been murdered as a witch, just as they would have done 4 or 5 centuries ago.
Yeah, I was thinking about that actually when I was reading through America Bewitched, which what an important book that is. Thank you so much for putting that together.
Glad someone's read it.
Everybody needs to read it. But I was thinking about how sometimes I've had the perspective that these women who were hanged or executed as witches 10 generations ago, some family lines kept it a secret. It was a shameful. They were scared. They wanted to not carry that reputation down to each generation. But as I'm reading America Bewitched and have all these examples, there's been every generation in some family where they were trying to quiet and minimize the targeting that's happened in their family. And that still happens in the modern families. Mm-hmm. That's one of the aspects of, oh, that's old witch history. That doesn't happen anymore. The secrecy of witch branding has continued. And I think that continues to, if generations are hiding it from their descendants, then that adds to the confusion or, oh, sure, surely this isn't happening anymore. I think that's something that needs to be recognized.
Yeah. People, you know, come and saying, oh, we're going back to the times of the witch trials. No, these times, it may not have been the state persecuting, but your neighbors, your family were persecuting people right through to just a few decades ago. We're not reverting back to the witch trials at all. We're still there. It's just that the state is not interested in it. Or hopefully for a long time, not anymore, but who knows in the future. This is why I always say, in giving talks and saying, you know, witch trials could come back in fairly similar forms. It just takes various certain types of people, certain types of things to happen. You hear the language of witchcraft being used more and more in the States in certain circles, and in the sense of diabolic witches. I totally agree with you. It's comforting to think these hangings happened in the 17th century, and then the Enlightenment happened. And we can look back and go, how strange. We can write histories about it and things like that. And that's comforting. That's why Salem is very comforting, I think. And that's why it acts as a way of saying, we're past that. And we can study it as something that will never happen again. And if awkward things happen since then, that's just a small number of people. So yeah. We were talking about states because it's America the Witch, but you can say the same things about other Western countries and other parts of the world. Persecutions, or those parts of the world where the state still persecutes you. I have to think of, you know, Saudi Arabia and fortune tellers and things like that, and executions that have happened today. People don't want to talk about that, though.
America Bewitched, I definitely recommend to all our listeners, because it shows like a bridge. We talk about what's going on in the modern world, and we talk about what's happened in the historic past, but they're all linked together. It's this one big witch hunt that's been going on forever that still continues. And it's easy to want to separate yourself from that and say, oh, we're better than that now, but we're obviously not.
And speaking of bridges, one other thing from your new grimoire book that's coming out, I loved that you bridged the old material with the new material in creative industries. That's so interesting here, looking at how you talk about the current creative works that involve magic.
Yeah, I thought it's important. You know, it comes back to that idea of particularly, you know, the imaginative side of magic. Physical forms in books here, but that creative side and how you see those continual expressions across cultures, across time, and the ways it crops up today with, and not just, well, I've obviously got some stuff in there in the final chapter, which is about Golden Dawn and books that came out, Waite and Mathers, etc. But I also, and also brought in Buffy and those sorts of things, as you would do, playing around with books of magic at the real time. Although that sense of creatives and artists, so I've got artists' interpretations of grimoires in there. Yeah, I find that fascinating how people are creating today. People are creating grimoires which don't actually have any magic in them. But there's a whole body of people who are creating works of art which are replicating what, or imagining what books of magic look like without them being books of magic. And that to me is in a sense an act of magical creation in its own right. And that, I think that's an interesting thing going on. And I think the other thing is across the global nature of this. Most books tend to think about written magic and books of magic and largely in Western terms. And like, yeah, people say, I'm guilty of that. And quite a lot of my work is mostly Western Europe. But the whole, I really had the intention here of saying we can find books of magic across every continent, different times and in different periods, and are there today. But there is huge, you'll see from the illustrations, you know, huge wealth of written magic and magic books and all sorts of different writing surfaces from different parts of the world. I think quite important not to break out of, again, Western ways of thinking of, you know, almost exceptionalism, perhaps, about our own traditions. Perhaps end on the role of magic in the world today and the fact that it's still with us. Old forms are still with us. New forms are always being created, depending how you define magic. And of course, science itself in the 20th century has adopted the language of magic to describe some of the things they do, like magic bullets and things like this. Another example of the ways in which magic is woven into our modern contemporary world. And you don't have to be a practitioner to think that's a really interesting aspect of our who we are as humans all the time. And that's a comforting thing. And on the flip side is the ways in which magic is still with us in terms of people conceiving how it can be used against them, which is what the fundamentals of witchcraft or other forms, whether it's technological forms of harm. And that's fascinating. And say in the other book I've got coming out, which is based on asylum records in particular, we find people in the 1880s, 1900s, and as soon as new technology comes out, there's always people who think that it's being used against them in supernatural ways. Electricity, batteries, my neighbor's using a battery against me. I can feel it. My bones are all crumbling. Or wires. They're doing things to me through the wires in my house. They put wires in my house. My neighbor, I can hear my neighbor talking, or they're using the telephone against me. These things crop up. So every time we think of technological advances, there's always going to be people who see technology in a different way to perhaps the majority on these. As I say, we see that today with 5G and other things. But also those little signs of that also always up to me are warning signs that we shouldn't be complacent about the ways in which magic in the conspiratorial way, which we talked about earlier, is with us and can be manipulated by bigger forces. So I think it's just that the ways in which all of this is still with us. Yes. And we're seeing it happening and changing. And I'm sure the same for you. I'm constantly trying to fit this in and work out what's going on today with politics and religion and society and going, I can see these patterns. Is it worth making these patterns? It's the same thing. It's completely different, but it's happening.
And when is Art of the Grimoire out and how can people get it?
Oh, I think, where are we now? 1st of September. I think it's out next month. I've got my copies and it looks fantastic. It's amazing quality production, I have to say.
Awesome.
I don't always say those things, but it is the feel for it and the paper quality and the print quality is fantastic. And I hope some of it will be familiar to lots of readers, for sure. But I'm hoping it was still, even those who are quite well engaged with history and magic, hopefully it will still open people's eyes to the global traditions and how, again, we can see how people are thinking in the same ways in different cultures at different times as us. We can get inspiration and learn from that. How you get it, you'll get it, and you can get the book easily. I think is it $25? So you're getting a full color, fully illustrated book for $25 about magic. Yeah. Can't be better than that. Can't be better.
No, it's jam packed with your research. The visuals are amazing. The way that you bring what you're showing and what it means together for people, I just know they're going to really enjoy the book. I think that it's something that people will keep picking up to look at some more. And now for a minute with Mary.
The Puritans had to provide basic education to their children by law for two reasons. Number one, all children had to learn to read the Bible. Number two, all children had to know and understand the capital laws of the county. This law was enforced by the town selectmen. Any family found not to be in compliance was fined 20 shillings per offense. The basic tool to teach reading was a wine book. This was made of a paddle-shaped board with squared corners covered with paper on one side. For preservation, the paper was laminated with transparent horn from an animal. The alphabet was at the top of the page, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Other ways children were taught was when Mama traced letters with her finger in the ashes by the hearth and sounded the letters with her children, repeating those sounds many times over. He might also place a Bible in the hands and point to the words as she read a familiar passage, familiarizing her children to the words. There are also other ways communities made sure this law was followed. Salem Village tried to accommodate families by developing a movable schoolhouse. Daniel Andrew, a relatively educated farmer, would teach at certain homes in the village for about 1 month at a time, hopefully covering the necessary education for all the village children. Now we know that at the very least, the Puritans had a basic education. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary.
Here's Sarah with End Witch Hunts News.
End Witch Hunts, a nonprofit 501c3. Weekly news update. Thank you for listening to a year of Thou Shalt Not Suffer podcast. Co-hosting this amazing podcast has been life-changing and transforming for Josh and me. This year of witch trial education and research has also changed Mary and our many volunteers and guests. We know that if you as listeners have learned what we have through producing this podcast, that you too have gained a priceless understanding of the timeless phenomenon of witch hunt behavior. The world can know that witch hunts are not an enigma. not a mystery. If you are new to our podcast, I have exciting news for you. You have a year of incredible topics and conversations to add to your podcast listening. Do you want to learn about the Salem Witch Trials? You will find several of our episodes are rich with that history. Do you want to learn more about the Connecticut Witch Trials? More about the descendants of the witch trials? More about the new Connecticut Witch Trial Victim Exoneration Bill that passed this May, clearing the names of the 34 individuals arrested for witchcraft crimes there? You can listen to historians, authors, and descendants right here. You can catch our 6-part Connecticut Witch Trial History 101 series. When you listen to our thought-provoking episodes each week, you are hearing the actual history and stories of the lives hurt by witch hunting. But wait, there's more. This past year, we also began reporting on and talking about the modern witch accusation violence that is harming innocent individuals in over 60 countries now. You can learn all about these violent and harmful events happening right now in 2023 and learn who is advocating in these communities to stop it. Thou Shalt Not Suffer podcast is a project of the End Witch Hunts Movement, a nonprofit in the United States working to amplify the work of witch hunt violence advocates around the world. Listen to these advocates share why witch hunts are still happening and find out how you can support their work with us. Listen to our Modern Witch Hunts 101 episode. We have to be part of the solution to stop modern witch hunt attacks. You have to be part of the solution to stop modern witch hunt attacks. Together, we can help advocates impact their communities. Witch hunts across the centuries are a part of the history of every nation. It is not a crisis of the past. It has been ongoing, and we need to keep talking about why we witch hunt, how we witch hunt, who we witch hunt, and how we stop hunting witches. Talk with us online and talk with your circle of influence. This is an ongoing conversation that needs your voice. The victims want us to use our voice to amplify their voice. We thank each of the busy historians and guests for taking the time to record important episodes for our listeners about critical witch trial history research. Together, we've created a critical message that will endure as long as we have victims that need us to keep talking. You can learn more by visiting our websites and the websites listed in our show notes for more information about country-specific advocacy groups and the development plans in motion across the globe. Get involved. Thank you for being a part of our work.
Thank you, Sarah.
You're welcome.
Thank you for listening to Thou Shalt Not Suffer, the Witch Trial Podcast.
Join us for another year.
Subscribe, rate, and review wherever you get your podcasts.
Visit us at thoushaltnotsuffer.com.
Remember to tell all your friends and everybody else you know about the show.
Thank you for your support of our efforts to end witch hunts. Visit endwitchhunts.org to learn how you can help more.
And be sure to pick up a copy of Art of the Grimoire.
Available October 10th at a bookstore near you for a very reasonable price.
Have a great today and a beautiful tomorrow.